the 0-1 to Contreras. Dribbler right side. This should do it. Horner will throw to first. Cubs win. The Cubs win the ball game by a score of 8-3 as they have beaten the Cardinals here in St. Louis.
Great way to finish off the pre-break portion. I used to say first half, second half, and I know we still use those terms, but it's not first half and second half anymore. It's pre-break period and post-break, and it's good to end with a positive outcome, as they did. A voice you heard on the score all weekend, and you often hear and see on Marquee Network, joins us now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com, Twitch.tv/Chicago670. The score, it is Elise Menaker of Marquee Network, who you can follow on Twitter at Elise Menaker. Hi, Elise. How are you?
Hey, guys. Good. How are you?
Elise, congratulations on the broadcast that you did with Beth Mowins and Taylor McGregor last week. Of course, I'm happy it happened as a woman, but I think it's a great thing that the Cubs were able to facilitate that. How did that come together?
Hey, Layla. Yeah, so it was just something that was presented to us. So it was a great opportunity because, I mean, that's for to have that come up, Nick Steger, Diane Penny, heavily involved, others as well at Marquee, and to have that come up and just be very natural, I think that was part of it too, because each of us have been and are in those roles consistently. It was just a matter of really putting us together in the same broadcast. So that was probably the most fun part about it. They were roles we're really comfortable in, and by putting us together, it made history. But it was a really special, really great day. I honestly had a blast. I thought it was just so well done by Marquee and the Cubs.
And as I understand, the Cubs are undefeated. So is there any talk of making this a more common thing, or maybe you guys got to break up a streak or two? You just never know.
I hope so. I mean, you know, I don't want to quit while we're ahead type thing, right? Because that's always nice too, to stay undefeated. But I hope there's more broadcasts in the future.
To what extent do you look at this Cubs resurgence and say, where was this? And everybody talked about it, and everybody was right that this is how they were supposed to play. You know, maybe not 6 of 8 with, you know, all the shutout innings and all that, but it's like, what took so long? And sometimes it does, and sometimes it's just variance, or was it something else?
Well, I mean, I think it's the ups and downs of baseball season. I definitely think the downs lasted longer than anyone expected. I remember when Jed Hoyer would say, like, you know, you were kind of, we're waiting to come out of it, and then you're waiting and waiting, and now you're like, okay, well, this is more than just like one of those, you know, bad struggling spells. But to your point, you know, we're waiting and waiting, and then they do come out of it. So it was really nice to see the offense come together, because that was part of it. But I mean, really, I kind of like during it was thinking about the injuries that they have had. And, you know, maybe in the end, in this first half, because I still call it first and second half, but the bullpen and the arms that you were missing, and in the rotation, just the pitching staff, have had a pretty big impact. Now, that doesn't affect the offense, but I just wonder the overall feeling on the team when you know that you are shorthanded, and how can that affect an offense and the pressure that those hitters put on themselves. So it was weird almost that there were a lot of guys struggling at the same time. They just weren't performing like we were used to seeing, or like we had seen on the back of their baseball cards. So now it feels like, you know, there's the confidence there, there's momentum there, there's rolling, there's key things happening that weren't really happening before. Hitting better with runners in scoring position, shutdown innings, I've been noticing more of those. So after the Cubs score, the next half inning, you know, the pitchers are able to shut things down. It feels like little things, but they're adding up, and they're adding on in games too. I mean, during this hot stretch, we've seen, you know, not just scoring early, but scoring early and scoring throughout and scoring late.
In your opinion, what was the either most frustrating part of what you saw to the Cubs' struggles the last couple of months leading up to their success?
The most frustrating part, the close games. I mean, it was hard. It was hard to continue to see close games, and they would usually be on the losing end of those. So it was probably the way in which they were losing, because they had chances in a lot of the games they were in. They just couldn't come up with that key inning on the mound or that key hit. at the plate. So it kind of felt like night after night we were watching the same game or day after day. And now, in a good way, it feels like we're watching almost the same game because the offense is clicking and, you know, guys are hitting. There's slug back. You know, there hadn't been a lot of home runs. And so now, you know, a season high 6 yesterday, and that was really fun to watch. So probably to see just more, you know, bigger wins, really, and just like more blowout games.
If you had, if there was one thing that you could put in Pete Crow Armstrong's brain as he walks into the batter's box, one little like Matrix style that you could just program into him, what would it be?
I think he is getting more comfortable. That's what I would say. And I think it's something that he's been working on. I mean, look, he's a young player, it's so early on in his career, and it doesn't feel like it because we've been talking about him for such a long time now, and there was so much anticipation, but he's 22 years old, and I think it's just like this element of where, you know, he's a really tough competitor, and with that, sometimes you can put a lot of pressure on yourself because you expect to perform consistently and constantly, and so I think you're seeing like a PCA come into his own where he has that, but then there's also those moments where he can kind of like take that breath and relax. And I think that would be the thing at the plate that I think we're starting to see. And confidence is a big part of it. Like PCA doesn't lack confidence, but you go through ups and downs and you'll have questions, you know, you'll think about things. No, struggling isn't fun. And so I think that you're seeing a player grow in confidence, and it doesn't even matter what you say to anyone, like confidence has to come from within. He has that. It's just building at the big league level. And I think there's a balance for him, like with the emotional side of the game and how to, you know, be himself while also managing the emotions that come with the ups and downs.
I think that's a good place to also discuss your observations of Christopher Morel recently. Of course, he hits a home run as well. What do you think of just the journey he seems to have been on, both offensively and defensively this season?
Yeah, it's like a journey that I feel like I can relate to a lot because, you know, just growing as a third baseman, it's something that I felt I did in college, like just kind of came into my own and really you learn your own strengths and weaknesses and so you try to improve the weaknesses and how do I use my strengths to make the best plays that I can. Morel has a good arm. It's just about having it be consistent. Timing is a factor at third base. The ball comes at you fast, but then the footwork becomes key as well. All of this stuff that he has been working on. And then at the plate, I think still just trying to become consistent as pitchers have adjusted to him adjusting back. I think it comes down to pitch selection for him at the plate. I like, you know, you can't not like the bat speed. I was going to say I like the bat speed if you want to say that in the positive. So, you know, he's got one of the fastest bats in baseball. With his swing, there will be swing and miss. And Dustin Kelly has even said this before, that like you'll have to live with some of the swing and miss with Christopher Morel. The question is just how can you limit it, but how can you increase the damage? Because when he makes contact, we know that he can hit it really hard. So I think it's just about being really stubborn in the batter's box, but I don't want to take away the fact that he is aggressive. So it's finding the balance there. And I think maintaining the confidence that even as he develops at third base, you know, knowing that you are an athlete, you can be there, but you've just got to make the routine plays because he's so athletic. He makes the hard plays look easy. It's about the routine ones, just staying within himself and not overdoing it.
I think you've also described a lot of what we've seen out of the Cubs hitters as a whole when you're talking about the plate selection and the pitch selection that we've seen. So that said, exactly. I know you want to add to it with just the threat to walk and then the threat to swing the bat. And then how do you combine it all?
Well, you know, you're rewarded in this game for getting on base. So taking your walks and strikeouts aren't, you know, as frowned upon as they once were. So swinging the bat and sometimes then taking your strikeouts with that. So, yeah, I mean, it's the cat and mouse game that you constantly see. More than anything, I feel like it's the mental side of it because these are all talented players. I mean, they're all good players. I feel like what was creeping in is how to stay within yourself, even though you want to be the person to get this team out of the rut. And that can be a really hard balance because you, especially like, you know, when there's a guy in second, you can see him, you want to come through. So in those situations, it's, you know, well, you want to be that hero a little bit more on that day because we haven't, you know, been winning as much. We are struggling. And so that's a really fine line in the game. But it, I think what you're seeing now is, all right, you're almost seeing like that collective breath that was taken as the wins were coming and guys are just themselves.
Now, I wonder how you felt when Hunter Biggie got into a game after Kyle Hendricks had left the game. Now, they say, well, why would you ask that? Well, Kyle Hendricks, we know, graduated from Dartmouth. Hunter Biggie is a Harvard man, and our guest Elise Menaker went to Cornell. I asked the question, was that the first time two Ivy Leaguers had pitched for the same team in the same game? Now, I don't know if you guys looked this up at any point, but
I got a question. I would like to know that.
The answer that I got from a longtime listener via Twitter was that Ron Darling of Yale and Jeff Musselman of Harvard were teammates on the 1989 Mets. And in both 89 and 90, said Musselman was strictly a reliever, so there's a good chance it happened. Now, I was not going through box scores, but we got to go back a long way to find that. It might be the only two times.
Not many, probably.
Right, not many.
Yeah. No, I loved it. Any time I see an Ivy Leaguer, I absolutely love it. Because I think inside of me, there was always like, yeah, we can play sports too. So, yeah, it's super fun. And that's like, you know, one of the reasons, there's so many reasons to love Kyle Hendricks, but I always like that bond that, you know, we kind of have. And the same thing with Hunter Biggie. I haven't met him yet, but I'm excited at some point to meet him. And because that's the fun thing to talk about, because there aren't many of them or us. And it's cool.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you probably get associated because of Cornell with the character Andy from The Office a little bit.
Yeah,
like that's
exactly
what I would distance from in a way in that respect.
Specifically, like, have you ever heard of it? You know,
did you sing in an a cappella group?
I did not sing in an a cappella group, but they're very good at Cornell. They're fantastic singers. I had a friend who is in an a cappella group. It was fun because there was one night we happened to be watching The Office. I was with a couple of my teammates and Nate Ford, who was the quarterback of the football team at the time, he was mentioned in an episode. And we were all like, they just mentioned Nate Ford? Like, they know us? Like, they're looking at Cornell, so that was pretty cool.
I didn't realize the a cappella group was real.
There's like 10 a cappella groups. You know how many a cappella groups Cornell has?
Clearly no.
Yeah, they're really good. I went to, like, a show. I remember going to one show. No, they're like, they're respected groups on campus because they're so talented.
My parents sang a cappella at Cornell.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
I feel so educated in this segment.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long time ago, but look, I thought Far Above Cayuga's Waters was my lullaby. Like when I was
I don't even know all the words to that.
Da 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 da.
Right, I know.
Yeah, there was that. I mean, there was between that and the and all the other songs. Yeah, that there was when I was
Hail to Cornell.
Yeah. That was my.
More than me.
They would sing me to sleep with it. Well, my sister went there too, and all my cousins and everybody else.
Cool.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So that I thought that meant it was time to fall asleep when I would start hearing that song.
I know it as the Dirty Dancing song. Like, it was in the movie Dirty Dancing, but with different lyrics, obviously.
Oh, really?
I think it's the same.
Could be.
The Kellerman song. We're way off.
So
base.
What do you do on a, at least
I
what
didn't
do you
even
do?
Know that.
What do you do on a break?
What do I do on a break? I'm on call right now in case anything happens. So if anything breaks, any sort of breaking news, you'll see me in studio.
Cool.
So I just kind of lay low. This is the time where I disconnect. I catch up on my HGTV. Reality TV. I'm always doing that. So,
what show?
Yeah. What show? Where do we even begin? How long do we have, you guys? I'm a big Bravo girl.
Okay.
Layla, I don't know if you watch like Summer House. Because Dan, I'm just assuming it's a no.
I used to. I don't watch
Southern
any of
Charm.
Them anymore. I don't know why.
My wife was
Real
watching.
Housewives.
My wife said the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader documentary is really good.
Yeah, I've seen videos of that on TikTok. That's another thing I do. I look at TikTok until my eyeballs burn out sometimes because I don't post on TikTok or anything. I just scroll through. So I have seen videos from that. I bet I would like that. I have not seen it. I believe it or not, I'm more of like a cable girl. I don't really, I'm not into all the extra stuff. I just keep it simple.
I think that as a cable network employee, that's definitely on brand. So as also a cable network employee, I thank you. I do want to ask your opinion since you are on call. Yeah. We've talked about the concept of the Cubs doing nothing, and that is completely reasonable at the trade deadline. Where do you sit with this? Are you a buyer, seller? Do you have to do something?
I think they'll look probably at pitching. I think every team pretty much does this time of year. But yeah, I'm still kind of in the, I'm not sure category because they're starting to play well. It feels like in a buy situation for pitching, that's kind of the situation that I'm looking at, especially with all the injuries they've had. They've been so shorthanded. It feels like it could trend in that direction.
Well, Elise, thanks for taking a small portion of your break time for us. Thank you.
Yeah. Happy to be a part of it. Great talking to you guys.
And educating me about Cornell with Dan. thank you.
Anytime, Layla, anytime.
That is Elise Menaker of Marquee Sports Network, host, reporter, and analyst, and maybe news anchor now if something happens. This hour is brought to you by Menards. Save big money at Menards.
Yes.
When we come back, there was Bob Nightingale dropping some little bombs here and there, mentioning who could be on the move and who's trying to move whom and what White Sox could be had for the right price.
This was the sneakiest of sneaky this week.
Doesn't he always do that, though?
No, this was a really long article with some twists and turns. And then at the very bottom, oh, here's 95 important things.
We'll get to all of them on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2, on Sports Radio 670 The Score,
score.
And 670thescore.com, in Odyssey Station.
Good first half, not going to pat myself on the back just yet, but yeah, I'm happy with where I'm at.
Was anything that stands out for a number or any, or just a feeling that stands out for you from the first half?
Healthy for the first half, that's always a plus. That's about all I'm analyzing right now.
Okay, first of all, what are you talking about, Garrett Crochet? I say first half, second half, too, but it's more than a half, and you've been excellent. That was him and Scott Merkin talking to each other in the clubhouse, which makes sense. But here's the thing. I am irrationally on the side of don't trade him, but I get why they want to. Bob Nightingale, in the sneakiest of sneaky Bob Nightingale news drops, at the end of a story about multi-generational baseball all-stars, dropped, I'd say, 20 bullet points. And part of them belonged to the interest in not only the Cubs in trading possibly for catcher Danny Jansen from the Blue Jays, but the discussion around Garrett Crochet, Eric Fetty, and Luis Robert. Here it is. The White Sox, who were uncertain that oft-injured center fielder Luis Robert would have high enough trade value to move, now are cautiously optimistic they can trade him. Additionally, the San Diego Padres recently made an offer for Chicago White Sox ace Garrett Crochet, but it was quickly dismissed. While rival GMs are uncertain now whether Crochet will be dealt, the White Sox still fully intend to move him. They are still open to moving anyone and everyone, believing that starter Eric Fetty should bring in a nice return too.
Mm-hmm.
I say easily that Fetty would be a nice addition to a playoff-seeking team. That makes a lot of sense. I understand wanting to trade Luis Robert. I think a change of scenery would do him good. It's Garrett Crochet that still sticks with me.
Why?
It's more to do with the pattern. Even though the past should not dictate this decision. It's good business for the White Sox, who are not competitive right now, to trade somebody who was drafted 4 years ago, who's at perhaps the height of his value. But from a meatball fan standpoint, it is really hard to see the same pattern repeating itself with no end in sight. Trade your best players to help the farm system that you can't bolster on your own, and then see if it works for a couple of years. You don't get enough, partially because your farm system isn't as strong as you want it to be, and you won't go the whole way to trade everybody or try to acquire everybody, like a Phillies, for example, in the Dave Dombrowski model, and then you start all over again.
Too often in some of these massive deals, you get a bunch of good, but that one guy you wanted, the team talks you off of somehow.
That's it.
And like, you know the jewel of another team's farm system. You've got to get that.
And there's a couple of examples we can give. 2021, the notorious salary dump year for many Major League Baseball teams. Yu Darvish trade, for example. The Padres somehow got away with not letting any of their top 10 prospects go until, I believe, the Mike Clevinger trade. Or was it Blake Snell? One of the two big name trades like that. But they certainly didn't in the Yu Darvish deal.
And if I remember correctly, when the White Sox accepted Yoan Moncada back from the Red Sox, and this is going to sound and really teach the lesson, perhaps.
But Crochet is the sale comp here and the pattern and beginning again comp.
Weren't they angling for Benintendi?
Here's the thing.
Weren't they?
Our friends at Sox Machine have done the math. And James Fox,
Sox Machine.
James Fox aptly put together a list of the 2017 prospects. And the relationship that the White Sox have with them is glaring.
Yeah, you kept getting back to the 2017 draft year, too, as being so fundamental to everything that they did.
James Fox did it. I didn't do it. He was the one to connect the dots, and then the dots scared the bejesus out of me.
Like never stopping chasing some of those
guys. Benintendi was number one. Everybody on the list for sale was on that list. Zach Collins was on that list. I think people involved in the Lucas Giolito and Adam Eaton trade were on that list. If you need a mission statement as to the roster decision, that was it. Like, Benintendi was the number one prospect on that deal. So that makes sense.
I understand what Garrett Crochet is saying, too. But I would say, go ahead and pat yourself on the back a little bit, man. Like, take a victory lap here. This is the time to assess and account. And, man, you're leading all pitchers in MLB in wins above replacement. You're the best pitcher in baseball.
Look at his strikeout numbers.
His strikeouts per nine is an astonishing 12.58. That's fantastic. His ERA is 2.44. His FIP is 2.36. XFIP 2.40. This is not a mirage.
No.
And you're at 107 and a third innings. That was not necessarily expected to be having started 20 games already. This has been a remarkable 100-game run here. Enjoy it. Go ahead.
Also, frankly, Chris Getz and Brian Bannister at least deserve to give themselves some pats on the back. This is what you wanted, right? This was the development of talent you wanted. You're the one who said he's going to be our opening day starter, even though he hadn't started a game. They deserve credit for this. They absolutely do. And I feel that same way about Eric Fetty. As you guys know, that was a trade that I was an acquisition I was happily encouraged by. But it's just that pattern and the cycle that makes me sad.
Here's something else that I found fascinating while looking at where Crochet stands relative to his peers. Of the top 17 pitchers in overall war value, the top 17 pitchers in baseball right now, who do you think has the hardest four-seam average fastball? It's Garrett Crochet. Velocity doesn't matter. Yes, it does. Velocity is incredibly important.
Velocity does indeed matter.
You have to get all the way down to Hunter Green at 18th at 97.9 to top Garrett Crochet's 97.1.
Jeez.
Really? No, that's his average. That is his average. Dylan Cease is at 96.9. He's 19th. mean, all these guys, Chris Sales at 95, Tariq Skubal 97, so Crochet's got him by a tenth. Like, the people, he's not doing this with guile. His stuff is great.
Also, just look at him. He looks different than when he first started with the team. He put on a lot of muscle. His delivery is incredibly fluid. It's efficient. Yeah, a lot of it is lower body driven.
And he does that leg kick with the flexed foot.
Straight leg.
Straight leg and flexed foot.
Yep.
So he gets the little 90-degree angle there. I don't know how he developed it, but if you're a kid and you're out there doing pitching motions, which is nowhere near as fun as it used to be, doing batter stances and doing pitching motions because they've all been so standardized.
Craig Counsell's is wild.
But nobody hits like that anymore.
We've never talked to him about it. And as a kid, watching his batting stance was fascinating.
Every kid of a certain age, like we used to do Jerry Morales and Bobby Tolan, every wiffle ball kid, of course, would do the whole council thing. But, that's like in golf, all the swings look alike.
Bagwell's the other one. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Bagwell had Pujols were fairly similar. But, like, man, it used to be everybody was weird. And who was the guy, Batista, who would be completely open and would just sort of stand there and look at you, face it, looking at the pitcher with both eyes before he'd step in the box. Yeah, that's the idea of doing... of signature batting stances, and everybody would do Julio Franco. You were mentioning Gary Sheffield's name came up earlier, that was sort of a mandatory thing you had to do.
We might have to do that segment, the baseball players who scared the ever-loving brains out of you when they walked up to the plate and you knew your game was over.
Which I think is cooler if the player wasn't necessarily great. Like David Ortiz and Jim Thome, Hall of Fame players who terrified everybody because they were great.
But man, David Ortiz woke up there every plate appearance and I was like, this game's done.
Yeah, I know. And he also is a 500 homer guy. But like, to me, the cool ones to find are the ones who were scary looking and always did destroy your team, but weren't that good.
Yeah, the people I keep going back to were good. They just weren't consistently good.
But as soon as you saw them looming, like, oh, no. And your poor pitcher. But, like, it was also like White Sox fans.
Angels' heart of the lineup in the early 2000s was
Salmon, Edmonds.
Gloss.
Troy Gloss.
Yeah, that was upsetting. If you're an opposing team.
But it worked the other way, too. It worked with your hitters against their pitchers when you certain times, like... White Sox fans will remember.
Yes, Josh Naylor versus the White Sox. Sure.
Good one.
We'll count that. Also a product of the Mike Clevenger trade, by the way.
Do you remember watching Harold Baines hit against left? And I know he would get hits against lefties, but both he and Daryl Boston, sometimes it looked like they couldn't see the ball or wherever the pitcher was releasing it, they never got a good look at it. And so maybe just how the old Comiskey camera was. But you're like, that's not fair.
Yeah, that's why I like the ballpark angle in St. Louis. I was like, you can really see some bat speed out of this.
Yeah, some will give
camera
you a
angle.
Much better illustration than others. Because whatever it was, you'd see Harold against the lefty, and you'd be like, "That it's coming out of his ear. How could he possibly hit that?
People like this on the text line, this segment.
Yes?
We just got a bunch of good nominations. Kevin Youkilis, yeah, I could see that for sure. Albert Bell.
Well, Calvert, are we talking about scary or are we talking about impersonated batting stances? Obviously, yes. Ryan Rayburn against the White Sox. That's, but did he look it, though? I know the results were there.
Didn't he have a lot of tattoos or something?
Ryan Rayburn.
Yeah, no, Youkilis for what you were mentioning. But no, for me, the batting stance was Bagwell. That was the one that never made any sense.
The wide, he and Pujols did the DiMaggio.
But Pujols generated more upper body movement. Bagwell did not.
But neither one would stride.
Bagwell would bend his back leg.
Both wide, yes, but both wide base, equal weight distribution, and then the lean back, like the lift and
but no, there were some people, man, they just came up to the plate and you were like, ugh.
Yeah, we're doomed. Yeah, this is we're doomed. It's over. What do you mean it's over? Just trust me, it's over.
I don't know if there are people currently like that, how I feel. You know? There was a time where Matt Kemp would be up at the plate, and I was like, no. It was like a month.
Mo Vaughn, good one, yeah. And Mo Vaughn,
But Craig Counsell, the batting stance was like a...
But as far as scary, like when you meet Mo Vaughn, You're
I know you know what
you're
I'm
shocked that he's not like 8 feet tall.
He's not?
No. He's like 5'10 or something, isn't he? What is he listed at?
Is he just like one of those movie stars who looks tall?
That's every movie star is short.
Yes.
Well, not, I mean, most are short. Not all. But a lot more than you think. They're all shorter than you think. But yeah, that was
Hunter Pence's batting stance, 219.
No, too much anxiety. With
you're
underpants.
All
no, it's all movement and weird and everything's kind of off.
I think they're saying Juan Gonzalez as far as like intimidating.
Ooh, yeah.
Dude, Juan. Yeah.
He's in your magic box score.
Oh, scorecard oracle. Maybe we do that this week.
Scorecard oracle?
Scorecard oracle may need to happen.
We've had that for years, right? Like literal years we've been talking about scorecard oracle.
We have, and it is now 22 years old.
Wow. Wow, but where have they gone? And their great hitting coach, Rudy Jaramillo, who is going to save
Bagwell.
Everything. Rudy Jaramillo is going to come to the Cubs. And he
do you know how many 50 home run hitters, 50, the Rangers had around that time? I don't think that's what was saving hitting there.
Well, they had Gonzalez.
Wando, like A-Rod had 53
that's right,
one
A-Rod
of the years.
Was there.
Then they had guys casually hitting tons of home runs like Rafael Palmeiro. Exactly.
Casually hitting home runs. That's one way to put it. Yes.
No, that's actually my point.
Well, that was the point that people made about Rudy Jaramillo.
But you know
Rudy, what
no.
are you bringing with you?
No, you know what? Let's pretend, because everybody else did. So theoretically, level playing field. There were still people during that time where when you saw them walk up to the plate, you're just like, guess I'm going to stop watching this now because I know the result.
You know what I started watching last night for a little bit, or throughout the weekend, I should say? I watched Bulls Summer League play. What now?
3-1-2. The reverse of this is literally any Royals pitcher who is garbage, but the Sox had no chance against them, like Brad Keller or Bruce Chen. They just had sliders, right? Like, that was
Cy
it?
Chen.
They just
had no, they also like Joe
Brad
Mays.
Keller just had a slider that was effective sometimes. Most of the... An amount of time that was needed.
Oh, Bruce Chen. Well,
this is not a compelling argument by me.
I have a pretty positive scouting report on a new Bull. I don't know what to make of Summer League. It's raggedy. It's often silly and disconnected.
It's for those who really love basketball.
But there's some stuff to scout. And I've got good news about the Bulls draft pick. So, because it can always be worse. It's better to be good in the Summer League than bad. And sometimes you see some things that you can't teach. We'll discuss on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, your midday destination for Chicago sports talk on 670 The Score.
Good defense by Sanogo.
Take it.
Bouzelis caught a body underneath. Matas.
Wow.
He looked mad on that.
There's not a lot of people in the building. They've left, but the ones that are here are on their feet. He gave a little life to the building. Mm. Oh, Mr. Bouzelis. I'm talking about tired. Forget that.
Mr. Bouzelis.
Yeah, you call him Mr. Bouzelis. No, you don't call him Matas.
Let's do it. Let's give him the name Mr. Bouzelis.
Well, he's, hey.
That is probably also his dad.
I will
who
say.
Who may be a P1.
Right, probably. Matas Bouzelis is, the motor is not going to be a problem. The motor is not going to be an issue.
Yeah, you said that about Dalen Terry, too. He's still honing his skills.
But he's bad. That's the difference. Now, this is Summer League. And
where everybody's bad.
This is Summer League, where the basketball will at times singe your eyes and affront your sensibilities, but get past that. Look at the bodies. Look at how they move. Look at how they take and make contact. Just look at the really raw scouting things would be my advice for somebody watching. Like, if you see this guy, Cam Whitmore, on Houston, holy crap! And I look at it, and then I realized, oh, yeah, he was Summer League MVP last year.
Yeah!
And how was he in the NBA? Not great. But but
it's like the bubble. The bubble was its own special thing.
Well, Summer League is definitely its own special thing.
Yeah!
But Matas Bouzelis is... I was texting with an NBA person last night, kind of with, like, you know, the goggle eyes and then a little question mark. Like, yeah, what do you think? And the response I'm getting was, he will be in a great position if he gets a lot of calories, a lot of workouts, and gets in shot lab with Peter Patton.
Man, that's the thing. Everything is different to me now in the post-Peter Patton disciple world. You know that they can hone people's skills and develop talent.
And I don't want to put too much pressure on one person. It's easy just because we happen to know the shooting coach's name. It obviously takes more than one person. But his understanding of when to shoot that, knowing this play is run for me, especially on the left side of the floor, he's very comfortable using a little bit of a curl to the corner or a turn out, like the hammer screen with a turnout. And he gets it and it's out. It's gone. He does not wait. He does not swing under and jab step. It took Patrick Williams forever to learn that.
You're right. The timing mechanism is important to point out here. I think that that's a very valid discussion. And, you know, they've made a longer term commitment to Patrick Williams. I know we talked about the team friendly aspect of the contract, but these are things that we deserve to be looking for. You know, you hope that not everybody picks up the other's deficiencies, but has their own. And then you have another person for those deficiencies and so on and so forth.
Yeah, team building. Yeah.
But for the example, that dunk that we opened up the segment with, that was awesome. It's making the rounds on social media for a reason. It was a great little dunk.
I like the floater even more. When he saw that he wasn't, his first thought was get to the basket. Two guys converge on him, and it's an effortless little one-hand floater. If that's part of your game, I mean, just the desire to attack. He runs the floor hard. He's always looking for the ball when he runs the floor. And Josh Giddey will find you now.
That's it. There's a couple pieces of this that you can start to visualize. Like, Giddey knows how to, he's space aware, right? Like, I think when you talk about spacing, he helps facilitate that.
Not with his own shooting, he doesn't. But
no,
yeah,
but
yes.
I mean, when it comes to facilitating.
Oh, yeah.
That's a piece of it. I think we saw that even against the Bulls, you know, when the Thunder played the Bulls last season. I also think that when you have somebody who's that quick with the shot, that's in theory creating more offensive efficiency, correct?
I just want him to get comfy.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it all plays. Like his skills mix, you can see why for a while early he was talked about as a possible number one overall pick. And I'm not saying that they got, it's a bad draft, and he wasn't the top pick in a bad draft. But I get it. And I've seen all the same highlights everybody else has, but a summer league game, he's playing with guys who at least physically are more of a challenge. And he looks really active, and he runs athletically. He doesn't run haltingly. And there's a motor there that looks good to me. The other thing that happened in Bulls world is that AK and Eversley talked at summer league. I didn't really think there was any big headline there. I didn't. I read through everything that Casey Johnson wrote and reported, but the fact that as of now they're saying that they expect Zach LaVine to be with them. I understand they have to say that. I'm told they are still actively trying to move him, and they would prefer to move him. They know it may not be at an optimal price, but that is still extremely fluid. They said Lonzo Ball will attend training camp. Now, I don't know exactly what that means.
I think they're still trying to figure out whether he can do NBA basketball activities.
Yeah, I mean, you got to see it. Like, at some point, there's got to be some effort to play real ball before you can even begin to bring him back.
Yeah, and that's how I feel about it as well. Yeah, Casey published the story yesterday. And, you know, I think the implication of just them not being done with making changes to the team. Here's my concern is always when it comes to LaVine, is this going to get to a point where you have to include something else?
That's the worry. No, I mean, maybe just not a first rounder. If you got to sweeten it with a second, I have no problem with that. That use the DeMar stuff that you got and attach that if you have to, because I do think that there's so much value for Kobe White. There's so much developmental value for others and your opportunity to lose some games that you need to lose without having a bad locker room to deal with.
And to protect the pick.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
That is such a small hole in the needle to try to thread. Think about what you're talking about there. Like, that's almost wishing for a unicorn of a situation. Players don't like losing, and it's like, whoa, lose enough.
No, you're not trying to lose, and you're not coaching to lose. You're just making sure that I think there's a way to do it. The 847 points out, so Bernstein, he was doing the things you wished Patrick Williams would do.
Oh.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes that you see that little spark to somebody's game that they want to just kill you. Patrick's not that guy.
I also just wonder how much of it is how he sees the floor. You know, it goes back to his position at Florida State where it's a very egalitarian offense, and that's not the case with the Bulls. So then do you just defer naturally?
I don't know. I did like what Karnišovas said about how small they look without Patrick Williams.
It's true.
And what his shooting meant. That's a 40% shooter who is 6'8 and 235.
But opposing defenses would just leave him open at times.
Well, not really, because he's too good a shooter. Not at 40%. I mean, he's improved that part of his game. I just think for the value of that deal, if he even reaches the low end of it, of being a solid 3-and-D NBA player, that is well worth that money. But Texter's right that Bouzelis does play with his hair on fire. And I'd much rather, from a coaching perspective, I would much rather have to rein that in, to get that under control, to figure it out, than try to teach it. And say, come on, play harder, play harder. If you got to try to pull him back a little bit, I'd much rather have that in a racehorse that just wants to go.
I'm just still trying to figure out how it all fits together.
Now let's give it 2 years.
Bouzelis, yeah, we don't have to worry about that for a while. But even say everybody's healthy. I know this is your summer league time, but I am naturally skipping ahead to at least the preseason time where I'm still trying to figure all of this out. Like, that's where I sit with it. You were asking me about it back at the draft, and I'm still worried about the big rocks in the jar versus the smaller rocks around them.
My hope is some of those big rocks will be gone by the time we're discussing exactly what you're talking about.
That's the game changer.
I told you that we had some giveaways. Now, this one's really cool if you're a fan. The Monster Touring Powerhouse Tedeschi Trucks Band is back. And they're bringing their impressive catalog along for the ride. This Grammy-winning band, led by the husband and wife tandem Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi, will be conquering the Huntington Bank Pavilion. Not just playing there, conquering it. At Northerly Island, Wednesday, July 31st. Caller 6 to the SCORE contest line, 312-540-0670, wins a pair of tickets to see Tedeschi Trucks Band perform their most amazing hits, including Midnight in Harlem, Part of Me, Hear Me, and many more.
Are you going to go?
July 31st. I haven't asked if we have anything yet on that date.
Maybe you should just write it in the calendar and be like, plans for Dan.
You can't really do that.
Why not?
Well, you can't. I mean, there's other things and other responsibilities. I can't just say, I'm doing this, I'm writing this. I'd have to cross-check and say, what else do we have? Is there anything to which we've been committed? Is there anything else?
Put a smiley face on it.
I think that'll just piss her off.
Like emoji smiley face.
Yeah, I don't know if that'll work.
What if you say, like, there's this really cool band, colon, plans for Dan, smiley face.
It's worth a try. Or maybe if I invite her to come with me.
That would also be a good idea.
See, there, that might actually
maybe
help.
You guys can wear matching aqua like we did today for some reason.
Look at us.
Bears.
Oh, cool.
I seriously walked in and I'm like, what?
We've got Bears coming your way next. We have all kinds of speculation as to why Caleb Williams and Rome Odunze remain unsigned.
Oh, that's right. That's just, you know, it's the same reason the Bulls haven't traded Zach LaVine yet, actually.
Same reason being... Hard Knocks.
That's why Garrett Crochet hasn't been traded. Correct. Clearly they're waiting for Hard Knocks.
Also waiting for Hard Knocks. But there are some possible actual explanations when we come back on the score.
Bernstein and Holmes, your midday destination for Chicago sports talk on 670 The Score.
Good defense. Hasanogo.
Take it.
Bouzelis caught a body underneath.
Matas.
Wow.
He looked mad on that.
There's not a lot of people in the building. They've left, but the ones that are here are on their feet. He gave a little life to the building. Mm. Oh, Mr. Vazelis. I'm talking about tired. Forget that.
Mr. Vazelis.
Yeah, you call him Mr. Vazelis. No, you don't call him Matas.
Let's do it. Let's give him the name Mr. Vazelis.
Well, he's, hey.
That is probably also his dad, may be a P1.
Right, probably going to do it. Matas Vazelis the motor is not going to be a problem. The motor is not going to be an issue.
Yeah, you said that about Dalen Terry, too. He's still honing his skills.
But he's bad. That's the difference. Now, this is Summer League. And
where everybody's bad.
This is Summer League, where the basketball will at times singe your eyes and affront your sensibilities. But get past that. Look at the bodies. Look at how they move. Look at how they take and make contact. Just look at the really raw scouting things would be my advice for somebody watching. Like, if you see this guy, Cam Whitmore, on Houston, holy crap. And I look at it, and then I realized, oh, yeah, he was Summer League MVP last year.
Yeah.
And how was he in the NBA? Not great. But but
it's like the bubble. The bubble was its own special thing.
Well, Summer League is definitely its own special thing.
Yeah.
But Matas Vazelis I was texting with an NBA person last night, kind of with, like, you know, the goggle eyes and then a little question mark, like, yeah. What do you think? And the response I'm getting was he will be in a great position if he gets a lot of calories, a lot of workouts, and gets in shot lab with Peter Patton.
Man, that's the thing. Everything is different to me now in the post Peter Patton disciple world.
You know
that they can hone people's skills. And develop talent.
And I don't want to put too much pressure on one person. It's easy just because we happen to know the shooting coach's name. It obviously takes more than one person. But his understanding of when to shoot that, knowing this play is run for me, especially on the left side of the floor, he's very comfortable using a little bit of a curl to the corner or a turn out, like the hammer screen with a turnout. And he gets it and it's out. It's gone. He does not wait. He does not swing under and jab step. It took Patrick Williams forever to learn that.
You're right. The timing mechanism is important to point out here. I think that that's very valid discussion. And, you know, they've made a longer term commitment to Patrick Williams. I know we talked about the team friendly aspect of the contract, but these are things that we deserve to be looking for. You know, you hope that not everybody picks up the other's deficiencies, but has their own, and then you have another person for those deficiencies, and so on and so forth.
Team building.
But for the example, that dunk that we opened up the segment with, that was awesome. It's making the rounds on social media for a reason. It was a great little dunk.
I like the floater even more. When he saw that he wasn't, his first thought was get to the basket. Two guys converge on him, and it's an effortless little one-hand floater. If that's part of your game, I mean, just the desire to attack. He runs the floor hard. He's always looking for the ball when he runs the floor. And Josh Giddey will find you now.
That's it. There's a couple pieces of this that you can start to visualize. Like, Giddey knows how to, he's space aware, right? Like, I think when you talk about spacing, he helps facilitate that.
Not with his own shooting, he doesn't. But
no, yeah, but yes. I mean, when it comes to facilitating.
Oh, yeah.
That's a piece of it. I think we saw that even against the Bulls, you know, when the Thunder played the Bulls last season. I also think that when you have somebody who's that quick with the shot, that's in theory creating more offensive efficiency, correct?
I just want him to get comfy.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it all plays. Like, his skills mix, you can see why for a while early he was talked about as a possible number one overall pick. And I'm not saying that they got, it's a bad draft, and he wasn't the top pick in a bad draft. But I get it, and I've seen all the same highlights everybody else has, but a summer league game, he's playing with guys who at least physically are more of a challenge. And he looks really active and he runs athletically. He doesn't run haltingly. And there is there's a motor there that looks good to me. The other thing that happened in Bulls world is that AK and Eversley talked at Summer League. I didn't really think there was any big headline there. I didn't. I read through everything that Casey Johnson wrote and reported, but the fact that as of now they're saying that they expect Zach LaVine to be with them, I understand they have to say that. I'm told they are still actively trying to move him, and they would prefer to move him. They know it may not be at an optimal price, but that is still extremely fluid. They said Lonzo Ball will attend training camp. Now, I don't know exactly what that means.
I mean, I think they're still trying to figure out whether he can do NBA basketball activities.
Yeah, I mean, you got to see it. Like, at some point, there's got to be some effort to play real ball before you can even begin to bring him back.
Yeah, and that's how I feel about it as well. Yeah, Casey published the story yesterday. And, you know, I think the implication of just them not being done with making changes to the team. Here's my concern is always when it comes to LaVine, is this going to get to a point where you have to include something else?
That's the worry. No, I mean, maybe there's just not a first rounder.
That's
if you got to sweeten it with a second, I have no problem with that. That use the DeMar stuff that you got and attach that if you have to, because I do think that there's so much value for Kobe White. There's so much developmental value for others and your opportunity to lose some games that you need to lose without having a bad locker room to deal with.
And to protect the pick.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
That is such a small hole in the needle to try to thread. Think about what you're talking about there. Like, that's almost wishing for a unicorn of a situation. Players don't like losing. And it's like, whoa, lose enough.
No, you're not trying to lose. And you're not coaching to lose. You're just making sure that I think there's a way to do it. The 847 points out, so Bernstein, he was doing the things you wished Patrick Williams would do.
Oh.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes that you see that little spark to somebody's game that they want to just kill you. Patrick's not that guy.
I also just wonder how much of it is how he sees the floor. You know, it goes back to his position at Florida State where it's a very egalitarian offense, and that's not the case with the Bulls. So then do you just defer naturally?
I don't know. I did like what Karnišova said about how small they look without Patrick Williams.
It's true.
And what his shooting meant. That's a 40% shooter who is 6'8 and 235.
Yeah, but opposing defenses would just leave him open at times.
Well, not really, because he's too good a shooter. Not at 40%. I mean, he's improved that part of his game. I just think for the value of that deal, if he even reaches the low end of it, of being a solid 3-and-D NBA player, that is well worth that money. But Texter's right that Bouzelis does play with his hair on fire. And I'd much rather, from a coaching perspective, I would much rather have to rein that in, to get that under control, to figure it out, than try to teach it. And say, come on, play harder, play harder. If you got to try to pull him back a little bit, I'd much rather have that in a racehorse that just wants to go.
I'm just still trying to figure out how it all fits together.
Now let's give it 2 years.
Zealous, yeah, we don't have to worry about that for a while. But even say everybody's healthy. I know this is your summer league time, but I am naturally skipping ahead to at least the preseason time where I'm still trying to figure all of this out. Like, that's where I sit with it. You were asking me about it back at the draft, and I'm still worried about the big rocks in the jar versus the smaller rocks around them.
My hope is some of those big rocks will be gone by the time we're discussing exactly what you're talking about.
That's the game changer.
I told you that we had some giveaways. Now, this one's really cool if you're a fan. The monster touring powerhouse Tedeschi Trucks Band is back, and they're bringing their impressive catalog along for the ride. This Grammy winning band, led by the husband and wife tandem Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi, will be conquering the Huntington Bank Pavilion, not just playing there, conquering it, at Northerly Island Wednesday, July 31st. Caller 6 to the Score contest line, 312-540-0670, wins a pair of tickets to see Tedeschi Trucks Band perform their most amazing hits, including Midnight in Harlem, Part of Me, Hear Me, and many more.
When are you going to go?
July 31st. I haven't asked if we have anything yet on that date.
Maybe you should just write it in the calendar and be like, plans for Dan.
You can't really do that.
Why not?
Well, you can't. I mean, there's other things and other responsibilities. I can't just say, I'm doing this. I'm writing this. I'd have to cross check and say, what else do we have? Is there anything to which we've been committed? Is there anything else?
Put a smiley face on it.
Think that'll help? I think I'll just piss her off.
Like emoji smiley face.
Yeah, I don't know if that'll work.
What if you say, like, there's this really cool band, colon, plans for Dan, smiley face.
It's worth a try. Or maybe if I invite her to come with me.
That would also be a good idea.
See, there, that might actually
maybe
help.
You guys can wear matching aqua like we did today for some reason.
Look at us.
Bears.
Oh, cool.
I seriously walked in and I'm like, what?
We've got Bears coming your way next. We have all kinds of speculation as to why Caleb Williams and Rome Odunze remain unsigned.
Oh, that's right. That's just, you know, it's the same reason the Bulls haven't traded Zach LaVine yet, actually.
Same reason being Hard Knocks.
That's why Garrett Crochet hasn't been traded. Correct. Clearly they're waiting for Hard Knocks.
Also waiting for Hard Knocks. But there are some possible actual explanations when we come back on the Score.
Fair.